Before I start the episode, probably 6 months have gone ever since the last episode came out, and I obviously owe you guys a big apology. Now, you see, being a 15-year-old student who's trying to get his career path set, it doesn't allow you to do many other things, one of these being the podcast. And so for the past 6 months, I have been nowhere to be seen, and I haven't been heard. And I must say, the world has changed, like it's gone through heaven and hell at the same time. A lot has happened, and I must apologize for not having released an episode for about 6 big months. But here we are. So once again, I welcome all of you back to Breaking Down Current Affairs of the World with Aryan Ghosh. And this is your very own host speaking to you at this moment. So obviously in the past 6 months there have been a number of updates coming out from around the world, and obviously major ones at this point range from Ukraine, where you can see a possible Russian invasion happening in January. At least that's what Ukrainian officials and American officials have been saying all this while. We'll be getting to that as well, but I think what's also important right now is that we focus on one particular region, because obviously a lot of things have happened. It's important to we break each one of them down. So these are basically short episodes I'll be releasing for the time being, just to see what all issues you might have missed, and you know, we'll cover them all one after the other. After that, we'll you know, check out exactly which issues in general episodes is put out. So let's today focus on Afghanistan, and that has frankly been a big disaster on part of NATO, the US, through all means. I mean, let's just put it on the record right there. So before we talk about the withdrawal, it's important that all of you understand what Afghanistan, the real situation there really is. Let's first begin with the year. It's not 2001, it's not 1979 either. To understand exactly what happened in Afghanistan, it's important to go all the way back to 1947. At least many believe 1947 was when the Cold War began. Now, the Cold War, it was basically this indirect war between the US and the Soviet Union. Now, unlike World War I and World War II, where you found basically expansionist policies of governments resulting in war, here you found a very stark ideological battle. It was not about expansion, it was about ideology. You had the US and the capitalist side on one side, and you had the Soviet Union and communism on a completely different side. Now, emerging from World War II were these two superpowers, the US and the Soviet Union. Now, they began to look at their ideologies as a very important beginning point to gain allies. And this created a Cold War. Now, why is it a Cold War, not World War III? Because look, World War I and World War II both were direct warfare. All right, you had fighting between countries directly. But here you found these two countries calling the shots, but they did it through proxies. Now, this is a technique called proxy warfare, where you indirectly fight a war. For example, say in a school, you and say some other guy want to fight with each other, but you don't want to basically fight each other and injure each other. Rather, you want to sh basically you want to get the other guy to be angry or get the other guy disappointed. So you hire another guy or get some other guy to fight on your behalf, and the other side is exact same thing. So you're indirectly fighting with each other. You're trying to gain allies in the classroom against the other guy. You're trying to put the other guy down by basically getting the entire classroom to go against him, right? That is something like what the US and the Soviet Union were also doing. The classroom was basically the entire world, and these two guys were calling the shots, but those executing them were smaller countries. And that's why the Cold War, if you look at the entire period of the Cold War, it revolves around these small wars that took place here and there. Now, obviously, there were big events like the Cuban Missile Crisis, when you had the world being one step closer to nuclear warfare. But at least one thing I always consider as the most important point of the Cold War, because this part of the Cold War really has affected us, and I think continues to affect us even today. That is the Soviet-Afghan War of 1979. Now, this comes at a time when the Soviet Union was gaining certain amount of advantage over America. Vietnam had just been lost. The Viet Cong had won, I think, the Soviet-funded Viet Cong, which is why America was now facing a bit of a stalemate in case of the Cold War, and this was not going anywhere. So in 1979, when the Afghan Communist Party had basically Soviet Union had begun invading Afghanistan in order to take control of it to make it communist as its own, what the Americans did was they saw this new uprising in Afghanistan against the Communist Party and the Soviet Union, that was the Mujahideen. Now the Mujahideen was this entire pattern number of leaders who came together who wanted to fight. They went from tribal leaders, even those who believed in Islamic faith, many of them came together to fight against the Soviet invasion, the Soviet occupation as they call it. And primarily, if you look at the Mujahideen that way, it has number of loosely armed opposition groups and number of fighters are fighting on, as I said, on behalf of Islamic faith against the Soviets and the Afghan Communist Party, or the basically the government then in Afghanistan. Now, what happened was the U.S. obviously saw an opportunity because, you know, again, it's against the Soviet Union. You don't want the Soviets to win. So the U.S. and NATO began backing these fighters. Now, along the U.S., there was Pakistan completely involved. Pakistan was completely involved when arming the Mujahideen against the Soviets long time before the U.S. did. And even there, apparently, the Chinese government and the Saudi government were also involved in such things as well. Now the Mujahideen saw a number of radical fighters come into the place as well. Radicalism became a very big issue. And you know, if you guys have Netflix, I would really urge you to go and see 9/11, The War on Terror. It is a really good series which gives you like this whole picture of how the war in Afghanistan, how it resulted in 9/11, how 9/11 changed the world in that way. And if you look there, you'll find facts that basically America for the first time was understanding how religion could be such a big issue in a country. And you know, this is not usually seen. Radicalism, you know, something US has seen before, not in Vietnam or anywhere else where radicalism was a big issue. Here, radicalism was becoming a huge issue because you had these insurgent groups using religion as a way of provoking people. And out of the Mujahideen came this group of young fighters led by Osama bin Laden, which came to be known as the Al-Qaeda. Now, back then, the US wasn't really aware about this, the US didn't care about it, and frankly, the US was simply interested in fighting in the Soviets. Now, when 1989, Mikhail Gorbachev, who was then the Soviet premier, had announced their withdrawal, there was obviously this chaos in Afghanistan, which wasn't seen earlier, because now you had all these regional warlords, these Pashtun tribes, fighting against each other for control of Afghanistan. I mean, at least it hadn't happened earlier, but it did come up in the coming years. Now, when the Soviet Union got dissolved in 1991, there was not much Russian involvement, but America and also apparently started arming the Mujahideen, but apparently the British and many of the NATO allies continued to fund it, continued to arm it, as a way of again opposing the Soviet bloc. Now, in 1991, despite the Russian Federation being formed, there are still allegations and those continued, and Pakistan also kept it as a buffer between India and Pakistan, because again, Afghanistan is close to India, and therefore, it forms the buffer zone between the two of them. Now, let's have a look at exactly how things went after the Mujahideen began fighting among each other. There came to be a new group of Pashtun tribes that came together, these groups and these people came together to form one organization called Taliban. Now, the Taliban under Mullah Omar, who was basically the one emerging as the leader, and when the Taliban were in fact able to fight in 1994, 1995, and finally formed a government in 1996, it was then Mullah Omar finally taken control and had become the head of state of the Islamic Emirate of Afghanistan, as you see it. Now, Taliban during this time obviously enforced what they call Sharia law. Now, Sharia law in that way, it's different interpretations. From what I understand, it's very much against women in a number of ways. It speaks about women being locked in their rooms. It doesn't give women rights to go out without a man, and a number of other draconian things that are done to women under those very laws, and that was completely justified by the Taliban. They would whip women who would go to get educated in schools. which shows exactly to the level of radicalism that religion had brought in Afghanistan for this very purpose. Now, what obviously came as an issue was that during this time, while the Islamic Emirate of Afghanistan was under this turmoil, there was someone else making the rounds in the world. That was Osama bin Laden. Now, bin Laden was not entirely wanted by the US back then because they still didn't consider him a threat, but he was calling for a jihad against America. He was calling for America to be killed. The US didn't act on it, and apparently, the Sudanese government, Sudan apparently had bin Laden, and they said they were ready to hand him over to the US, but the administration then said that they didn't want him because they didn't have anything against him. So, what they thought it would be better was to simply send bin Laden to Afghanistan. I mean, what would the guy do there? Well, guess what? He formed the Al Qaeda, not formed, he strengthened it further in Afghanistan, made Afghanistan perhaps the most powerful branch of Al Qaeda. I mean, if I'm not wrong, the most powerful branch of Al Qaeda is in Afghanistan, it's followed by Yemen, the second one. So, obviously, you find bin Laden now having gained enough supporters, and he was gaining people around his idea that the US really is this anti-Islamic force. And after the Gulf War, when you found Iran and Iraq in this big tussle for power, and the US getting involved in it by providing support to Iran, you actually saw that basically this was exactly what bin Laden wanted. He wanted that this happened because this proves his point that the US was against any kind of against Islam, against these Islamic countries, was going to go and get them. So, which is why bin Laden was able to radicalize people towards the fact that the US was this colonizing power which wanted to take over all Muslim countries. Oh, and yeah, wait a minute, wait a minute. The Gulf War, well, no, this is different. The Gulf War isn't the Iran-Iraq War, just I got confused there. The Gulf War basically is this war which the US and its coalition forces began attacking Iraq for the Iraqi invasion of Kuwait. It was regarding some oil dispute which Iraq and Kuwait had. So yeah, just a correction there, just don't like get confused in the Iran-Iraq War, that is different. But the one involving the Iraq invasion of Kuwait, and this was followed by a US invasion of Iraq and its coalition forces. So, what basically happened was this narrative was formed, right? Now, in 1998, there were a couple of embassy bombings in Kenya and others, which were basically perpetrated by Al Qaeda, or I think it's affiliate the Al Shabaab, which also operates in Africa, basically in Kenya and Somalia. The Al Shabaab has been a very active branch of Al Qaeda in Africa, which is why. Then the US began wanting, basically bin Laden was a wanted terrorist, and it was now known at that point that the Taliban and Al Qaeda had this kind of an understanding that the Taliban did not actually want the Al Qaeda to provoke the US. I mean, why would they, right? The Taliban knew that the Americans would in fact end up invading them if Al Qaeda continued doing this. But then one leverage which bin Laden was able to get on Al Qaeda, on the Taliban was that Al Qaeda could simply help the Taliban domestically, because after the Mujahideen took after the Taliban took power, what other Mujahideen fighters did, and other local tribes and warlords, they came together to form this opposition to the Taliban known as Northern Alliance. And the Northern Alliance now came up to be this huge opposition force to Taliban rule in Afghanistan. They understood, the Northern Alliance, that there was a problem with the way the country was being governed, because you actually had no governments. There were amputations of people just for the smallest of crimes. People used to get executed for just a random thing, like about even like something like stealing. The price of having like the punishment is just unimaginable, and that shows that for governance you're basically involved in ruthlessness against the people, and that's something can't be accepted. Not to mention the very like disturbing images of women being whipped on the streets by Taliban. It was completely disturbing to be there in Afghanistan at that time, and many people had actually gone out of Afghanistan for that very reason. And the Northern Alliance was this only one opposition. And the Northern Alliance was led by was Ahmad Shah Massoud, who was this guerrilla commander who fought against Soviet occupation and now was leading the Northern Alliance. And he was this great leader who had this great influence among the people. And frankly, he was someone whom the Taliban weren't able to completely crack down upon at all. So that is why what Bin Laden did was, he did what they couldn't. He killed the leader of the Northern Alliance. Right out there, he killed Ahmad Shah Massoud. What basically happened was, apparently, the Al Qaeda had sent two militants who had disguised as journalists. They asked Ahmad Shah Massoud for an interview, asked him to look into the camera, and basically they were holding a gun. They shot him and they left. Now, this is when you find that the Al Qaeda has helped Mullah Omar in taking out a very important ally, a very important enemy, sorry, a very important enemy at this point. And that is why the Taliban still allowed Al Qaeda to operate in Afghanistan, conducting these terror attacks. And that's when, obviously, in 2001, 9/11 happened. And it was frankly a very dark day for America. You had the planes hijacked by Al Qaeda militants crashing into the two towers of the World Trade Center. One crashed into the Pentagon. Now another was supposed to be hitting the Capitol building of the White House, but it ended up crashing somewhere else. I just forgot the name of the place, but it crashed somewhere else. Apparently, the passengers had overwhelmed the pilot, and they got the plane to crash down. I mean, again, it was completely disturbing to see the image that day. It was completely something no one expected. And what it did was, it brought America into fear. It brought this idea that the US wasn't this superpower, that it could be brought down by a group of militants in just one strike. And there were lots of other issues, the fact that intelligence wasn't right, that US agencies as the FBI and the CIA did not cooperate properly, intelligence operations, and they could have tracked down these militants long time back if they just done that. But it had already been too late, and the entire country was obviously shocked. Now, you know, one very important concept you understand is that fear always tends to make people bow down to you and do whatever they wanted to do. And fear makes people angry, and sometimes when emotions get the better of you, you end up doing things that you wouldn't have done if you were in a sane mind or if you were just calm. What happened was, America ended up doing something which kind of didn't resonate calm. It invaded Afghanistan. First, it had approached the Taliban, asked them if they were ready to handle Al Qaeda. It didn't. And obviously, under Article 51, which of the UN Charter, which actually allows right to self-defense, and obviously, since here in this case, the US did diplomatically negotiate with the Taliban, but it didn't end up having any effect, the US simply used the self-defense and they invaded it. NATO obviously invoked Article 5 of NATO Charter, which basically means collective action, collective military action against the Al Qaeda. Now, what also happened was, there was a bill passed which gave the president wide powers ranging, regarding defense and war. I forgot the name of the bill, but it basically authorizes the president with wide powers. And the very interesting part of it is, it does not involve just Al Qaeda. It's not like it's one organization targeting. Talking about groups, countries, members, individual entities. Those are words used. And if you see such general terms being used in a law which gives the president wide powers, they are open to abuse, as simple as that. And I mean, that is exactly what happened. Now, while George W. Bush didn't use that law too much, the Obama administration had used that law multiple times to justify illegal drone strikes against many individuals or suspected terrorists in Yemen, in Syria, and such other places. Now, we come to it later, obviously, but after the US had invaded Afghanistan, they had provided armed support to the Northern Alliance to fight against Taliban, and they ended up collapsing Taliban in Afghanistan. Now, when that happened, obviously, there was a great joy, great victory, and now it's time to begin reconstruction, because if you're going to destroy a country, you may as well reconstruct, right? I mean, come on. So the US began their process. But then what happened was, suddenly you found the US taking draconian steps, like the Patriot Act, which gave them allowance of to go for surveillance for anyone and to process data. And that is obviously against an individual's rights in the US Constitution. I mean, how is it even allowed? So the Patriot Act as a law was passed, and this allowed the US to become this sort of authoritarianism was almost on the rise in this kind of a way. And when you find such measures being taken, these are driven by emotion. People think these will work, but they don't. They end up helping the terrorists. And you know, you should never be the person you hate. You should never hate the person so much that you become that person one day. That's something I have learned a lot in my life, and I'm telling you, this is something which even applies to the situation. Now, the US had Guantanamo Bay. Now, Guantanamo Bay was a part in, is actually Cuban territory, but according to some treaty signed between Cuban and the US, US owns that land, and only the US can be the one to say that, you know, no, this land belongs to you. So Cuba can't do anything about it. So the US, what they started doing was that they understood what legal implications taking prisoners would be, right? So instead of using the word prisoners, they started using the word detainee. So it doesn't apply under the Geneva Conventions, anything like prisoners of war, right? So it started rounding up suspects, rounding up suspected militants, suspected terrorists, and bringing them on planes tied up with their heads covered to Guantanamo Bay, where literally there is no law. I mean, if you look at the series on Netflix, you'll find out that there was literally no rights. It was like outer space on Earth. And that is why the US was able to get over with torture, with waterboarding, those tactics, sleep deprivation, then hitting them wherever they're hitting them in particular places. I mean, look, just because they're hitting them in particular places doesn't mean it isn't torture. Waterboarding is almost like torture, and I mean, the reason why they were able to get away with this was because of a legal technicality in the Geneva Convention. Prisoners of war weren't mentioned, detainee was. Now, obviously, the world watched as this happened, and the US began torturing these civilians. Now, obviously, what was to happen was that Bin Laden was able to use this opportunity, and people saw the US was not doing was wrong. And this is completely against the American nature, American values, right? America speaks of democracy, speaks of human rights, and seeing this is completely different, right? The Taliban now began coming back in Afghanistan, 2008, 2009. But there was a different reason behind it. You see, in 2003, the Iraq war broke out. Now, the Iraq war is also linked to this, very ironically. The thing is that in Guantanamo Bay there was a particular informant in the US, not an informant, but basically a quote unquote a Taliban or Al Qaeda recruit apparently, who basically was called a Secretary Colin Powell, who was the Secretary of State back then, and in a Security Council meeting of the UN Security Council, he basically stated that the detainee had mentioned that basically Al Qaeda was operating in Iraq. Now, apparently, Iraq was violating its treaties, as in the WMD agreements it had with the IAEA, which is the International Atomic Energy Association, I think. And Iraq was violating the WMDs, which is weapons of mass destruction. And that Saddam Hussein, who was then the head of state of Iraq, was actually arming Al Qaeda with WMDs, with chemical weapons, and all such important, such very dangerous weapons. The case which Colin Powell made in the Security Council was that the UNSC should begin taking action against Saddam Hussein for this very purpose. I mean, obviously, a violation of a UNSC resolution does call for military action, at least it does call for joint military action, I think so. So that's why the US wanted this to happen. But I mean, the Security Council wasn't completely on board with this, and but it was too late already. George W. Bush announced on live TV that he was going to begin bombing parts of Iraq to disarm Saddam Hussein. There was no WMDs present in Iraq. The entire administration went on lying about how Al Qaeda was operating, where they were operating, and all of that, but didn't have a single thing Al-Qaeda didn't even exist in Iraq. I mean, it doesn't make sense. Saddam Hussein had just got over the Gulf War. Why the hell would he want to again provoke the US? It just doesn't make sense. And especially after Al-Qaeda did in Afghanistan, why would they want to deal with them right now? So, at the end, you got Saddam Hussein was brought down. And the US now became another occupying force in Iraq. This became a compelling case for the Al-Qaeda. And obviously we all know what a power vacuum can do, right? Now, a power vacuum in Iraq basically ensured number of regional militias grew out of there. The Iranian Hezbollah to get involved because, Iraq was always this buffer between Saudi Arabia and Iran, right? But now Iraq having gone to the Americans, the Iranians were quite scared. So the Hezbollah got involved there. And then you found this power vacuum giving rise to a new group known as the Islamic State of Iraq. This was the offshoot of Al-Qaeda. It because there was this lot of disagreements between the Al-Qaeda leaders and the Islamic State leaders. And then they completely got detached and became the Islamic State of Iraq. Later it became the Islamic State of Iraq and Syria or ISIS. So you saw the American administration trying to solve one problem, making 100 more. So what basically happened in 2008 was, with obviously instability rising, the US had to shift its resources from Afghanistan to Iraq. And that's when the Taliban and Al-Qaeda found the perfect opportunity to begin rising back to power. They started in district after district. The US began deploying troops in Afghanistan yet again. And obviously there was great pressure upon the Obama administration as to how to handle the situation. So now, how do you handle the situation best, but without any casualties on your side? I mean, you don't care about what happens to Afghan people, you care about your people, right? So let's see. A direct invasion on the ground, my troops might get killed. But what if I send an unmanned aerial vehicle? I don't care about the casualties, but I might or might not get a terrorist. Okay, cool. I go with a drone strike one because that doesn't involve my people at least. So, what the US did was it began going for unmanned aerial vehicle strikes, so UAVs. Now, UAVs can be drones primarily, and these drones can be surveillance drones, they can also be at the same time armed drones, like the M19 Reaper, I think, is one armed drone. And I mean, I can be corrected here. I have been trying to research on drones, so I have been trying to keep a track. But drone strikes by the US have been highly inaccurate in multiple cases, and they have caused much more civilian casualties. You have experts coming out and saying that you want people to be on your side. How is that possible? You don't even have accurate information. The guy you're targeting is a terrorist. When you target him, you have multiple casualties. So in order to kill one enemy, you're creating 50 more. And so obviously, this is another big problem of counterterrorism. If you're conducting airstrikes, you're conducting drone strikes, do it in areas where civilian population is very less. Or if you're gonna do it on a civilian population, at least be sure that he's a terrorist. That you are completely sure that this is a very high value target who needs to be gunned down. So that is very important to consider. The US didn't do that. And now what you find is basically what you find in Afghanistan right now is that earlier the people were completely oppressed by the Taliban. They weren't happy with them. They were seeing the terrorism. They were seeing the economy going down. And they couldn't take it anymore, right? And you see the Americans coming in. You're happy they're here. There's Western culture, Western influence, democracy, human rights, etc., etc. But that's just too good a fairy tale, isn't it? So now the people finally started seeing that the US was ending up being just like the Taliban. It was oppressing people, it was ending up killing people through drone strikes. And so the people began siding the Taliban. I mean, just imagine how bad you must have to be for people whom you've liberated to go back to the oppressor. I mean, that's a different thing altogether. And this is, I think, a very important concept to understand. And this, I'll come to this concept talking to about later because this is very important to understand, not only this war but every single war which is being fought right now. So, you find this emerging support for Taliban. The US strategy could not be worse. But then the Obama administration announced that it would be withdrawing troops according to per deadlines. There's one thing in military strategy you should never do. Never tell your opponent when you're backing out. The fact is that the US did that. It did not secretly, or at least with the Afghan government, it did not secretly with the Afghan government set up back then. They did not secretly begin withdrawing troops. They publicly launched them. So the Taliban and Al-Qaeda were waiting for this moment, and they continued preparing for it up till then. Now, look, these are important details about the US response to the Afghan crisis, but let's understand first what the Afghan government, which was formed after the US invasion. And there were quote-unquote democratic elections held, and Hamid Karzai became the new leader, the president of Afghanistan. What was something about the Afghan government that people didn't like was that it was corrupt to a different level. I mean, it's worse than brain cancer because you cannot take it out. It's embedded in the Afghan administration. And Hamid Karzai might not have been corrupt, but he took all steps necessary to protect the corruption, to keep it there. And you found American dollars, humanitarian aid money, and others were just going out into flames because it was all going to corruption, corrupted officials using it for lavish parties, using it for themselves. And you saw people looking at the Afghan government and being like, "This is not our government, this can't be." And the US had formed a number of agencies responsible for looking over humanitarian aid, looking over financial aid given to Afghanistan. And there were reports being brought up by those agencies that look, there is a problem. This money isn't going for the right purpose. It's going towards corruption. And that's when you understand how American dollars funneled corruption in Afghanistan. And if you look at even the Washington Post, what they had written, it's basically called the Afghanistan Papers. They had about exactly this, about how the US money was able to funnel corruption in Afghanistan in that way. And even they even had about how opium was a big problem. Now, opium is a drug known. It's grown through poppy seed or poppy plants, which are grown and cultivated, and then they are sent to processing plants. The processing plants then take measures to make them into opium, heroin, etc. That's how it's done, I think. Now, what basically the Taliban were doing is they were illegally taking opium and were still making money out of it. I mean, ironically, again, ironically, they say practice what you preach, when the Taliban did not practice what they preach. They told people to not use opium for business, not use opium for themselves. They completely banned opium trade. But guess what? Guess who was making money out of opium? The Taliban. Now, the Taliban was making money out of opium illegally, and the US wanted to bring it down. Now, what happened was instead, the people, the villagers who were basically making money out of opium were now facing losses, and the Taliban gained their support. And burn down opium didn't help at all. The Taliban simply gained support to grow more. And so this illicit drug money also helped the Taliban to prosper. Drug money has helped cartels to prosper. If you look at Mexican cartels, the Sinaloa cartel, drug money helps them prosper. The same with the Taliban, even now. And the fact is, Afghanistan is very well known for its opium. I mean, frankly, I think one thing also, which is a big debate, I mean, the reason why India as a country hasn't been able to yet deal with the drug crisis. It's because India is surrounded by countries which are the biggest peddlers of illegal drugs: Pakistan, Afghanistan, even Myanmar. And now Afghanistan had a played role in drugs too, and this helped Taliban make money, while the Afghans and the Americans were in a different ball game altogether. Now, obviously, in 2018 or something, during that time, the Afghan government had in fact announced elections, which then were challenged between Abdullah and Ashraf Ghani. At the end, Abdullah agreed to a deal with Ashraf Ghani, and Ghani became president. Abdullah became, I think, another minister in the government then. And there was this huge rivalry in the Afghan government, but at least Ghani was still under control. Now, during all this time, what happened was, while the Obama administration issued guidelines, issued these deadlines for troops to continue going back, the Taliban, Al-Qaeda advance went even further. And so now they realized there's no point, they had to send more troops in. And that's what happened. In the meanwhile, in the US, there were memos coming out, there were interviews coming out, and people could see that generals were like saying something out there in the public, saying something privately, completely different. In the public, it was a narrative that the US was, you know, quote unquote, fulfilling its objectives in Afghanistan. But honestly, it wasn't. It was becoming a total problem for them. See, in a place like Afghanistan, radicalism becomes a big issue. Counterterrorism is not a problem. Counterterrorism is something that can be solved by intelligence agencies, proper intelligence sharing, cooperation among partners, tracking down the particular individuals involved, making sure that they get justice, etc., etc. That's counterterrorism. That's like countering terrorism on the ground, right? But counterinsurgency is a different concept. It's about basically redesigning, it's a designing society. A society which has been plagued with terrorism, radicalism, you're basically making it a society which basically welcomes your ideology, which welcomes your thinking. So the Americans tried that. Now drone strikes, harming the economy of Afghanistan, you know, those aren't really the best tactics for counterinsurgency, you know. They rather help in insurgency further. So the people weren't also on the side of the Afghan government, of the American government. And then obviously the Trump administration came in. Donald Trump always kept on showing that Afghanistan was somewhere the US had to get out. And if you, I mean, it's, see, this is Trump we're talking about. Donald Trump, I mean, I mean, it's, whatever he says is like, I mean, how do you put this? Even in a situation like Afghanistan, can be reduced to a joke thanks to him. And if you watch that series, you'll see exactly what he says. He didn't care about the Afghans, he didn't care about them at all. He bluntly said, I mean, just don't care about them, they're getting out. So that's when comes the Afghan peace negotiations with the Taliban. I mean, the US negotiations with the Taliban. And guess what? The home country wasn't even involved. I mean, imagine that. I don't know if you guys know a lot about World War II. But the Munich Conference, which is set between Nazi Germany, America, Britain, and Italy, you know, it was regarding Sudetenland, that was an area of Czechoslovakia. And guess who was at the Munich Conference? Czechoslovakia. I mean, the US and Britain told Nazi Germany, hey, listen, you can take Sudetenland, but don't take the full of Czechoslovakia. And outside the conference room, Czechoslovakia was like, come on, man, you haven't even involved me. And that is the same. I mean, these Afghan talks reminded me exactly of the situation. I mean, you have to wonder that your country's fate has been decided in a room. Your enemy is speaking to someone else, not you. And they both are going to decide a country's fate. How bad can it possibly get for you? And that's when it happened. And the US and the Taliban completely planned that, look, at this date we'll get out. In May we'll get out. Alright? And it told the Taliban exactly that. You do not tell your enemy when you're planning to give up your sword. That is not how it's played. In war, you can never tell your enemy what you're going to do, because you never know how the enemy is preparing for it. And that's exactly what happened. There's one point about the US regarding this negotiation, which should be, I think, like busted, this myth. It's a myth, frankly. That the US had eliminated Al-Qaeda, or the Taliban had eliminated its links with Al-Qaeda. I think we can very much say it's false. If you look at UN reports, for example, the one the counterterrorism committee, the UN committee formed pursuant to UNSC resolution 1988, I think, 1988, that committee has published reports which show that the Al-Qaeda and the Taliban are like closer than ever before. The Taliban and Al-Qaeda are close in an alliance like never before. I mean, you have the Al-Qaeda leader, the current Al-Qaeda leader, speaking with Taliban leaders about the peace negotiations and constantly giving you updates about it. That's literally what the committee has been saying. So the Taliban having eliminated links with Al-Qaeda, not really true at all. Oh, and by the way, in 2011, the US was able to eliminate Osama bin Laden, after which although bin Laden died, Al Qaeda grew much more support. You shouldn't call Afghanistan a graveyard of empires. It's more of a the birth of ironies. Because each and everything here is an irony. You find that the US wanted to go after bin Laden. They thought by killing the leader, for some reason they thought that killing bin Laden would mean weakening Al Qaeda. No, it made him a martyr to the Al Qaeda militants, and that's why they were able to gain more support, and now Al Qaeda has grown more powerful than ever before, both in Afghanistan and abroad. Even if you look at Somalia, where the US has again withdrawn, the Al-Shabaab continues operating there in full force. So let's understand this. After Bin Laden was killed, Al Qaeda became stronger, much stronger. And as I said, the committee formed pursuant to UNSC Resolution 1988 had concluded that the Taliban and Al Qaeda still are very much close together. But the US still went ahead with a deal, wanted to get out of Afghanistan. Fine, that happened. Following that began the intra-Afghan negotiations. And finally, the country whose fate has been decided was able to negotiate. So Afghanistan was able to finally come like hand in hand with the Taliban. The government and the Taliban began negotiating. But then there came several hurdles along the way regarding political prisoners primarily. Because prisoners had to be released by the Taliban, Ghani wasn't willing to budge, and at the end, but the US told the Taliban, "We'll give you the prisoners." But those were under the authority of the Afghan government, and the Afghan government wasn't there in the negotiations. So the US ends up undermining Afghan government authority completely. And now there is a new pathway for a withdrawal of US and NATO troops, obviously. And the intra-Afghan negotiations aren't working. In the meanwhile, what's actually very, I'd rather say very sad is that while the US negotiated with the Taliban that you don't affect or harm our people or harm our troops, they just let the Taliban get a free license to go and kill Afghans. And you find big members of Afghan civil society being targeted, being killed by the Taliban. And there's constant mayhem and violence in Afghanistan. Now, following this, obviously, when the US also had actually left the Bagram Air Base, which is perhaps the most important air base in Afghanistan and of very strategic importance, the US left Bagram Air Base, and then it was done without Afghan government's like the Afghan government wasn't even aware about it. The US withdrew from the base without even telling the Afghans. And then, as the US slowly withdraws and finally formally withdrew, what was surprising and shocking to all, I think I had said about a couple of I mean so many months ago when I spoke about Afghanistan, I said don't withdraw in one go, don't do it that way. Do it in a phase manner and keep some troops in Afghanistan to keep a watch to see if anything goes wrong. So the US at least have something to defend the Afghans with, because look, an army in today's world cannot be won by numbers. It is won by strategy. And as I told you, that concept I was speaking to you about, I'll be coming to exactly that, because this is the central thing in Afghanistan and in every war we're seeing right now. Looking at how we see at this point, Afghanistan is in a very complicated situation with the Taliban, which is now rising. The US is withdrawn. The Afghan government is getting ready for a war. Now, the Taliban were now taking district, province after province. The intra-Afghan negotiations were at a complete standstill. And as it went on and on, military officials in the US didn't care. They thought that it is completely, nothing's gonna happen. The US, the Afghans won't fall. Even Biden himself was very confident. He said that they are not. This is not going to be another Vietnam. This is not going to be another defeat for us. This is going to be. They're going to hold us fine. Within a week, Kabul fell, and the Taliban took power, and they formed the Islamic Emirate of Afghanistan. That is how a 20-year-long war comes to an end. Look. I understand from the point of US lawmakers and Democrats that Biden had the guts to withdraw from a war, but honestly, The US owed Afghanistan everything because the US ended up invading Afghanistan, destroying all of its people, all of its property. I mean, if you look at the ways in which the IEDs are planted by the Taliban, when the US had to eliminate those IEDs, those bombs basically, they used to end up blowing up whole towns and buildings and causing destruction everywhere. That is how the US ended up destroying Afghanistan inside out. And I really don't see as to why at this point we should become complacent in the fact that, knowing the fact, I mean, we are all complacent in the fact that we aren't accepting the US made a mistake by going in there. I mean, there should have been a much more protracted conflict rather than going to full-blown war which you know you can't win. Or perhaps there should have been full concentration of Afghanistan and not going into Iraq. I mean, US lawmakers keep on praising Biden that, you know, he went out of Afghanistan, got our soldiers back. But what about the Afghans? You betrayed them. You killed their people. You killed Afghan civilians just because one of them was a terrorist. I mean, you didn't even have proper information about that. And now look, you've created this power vacuum where now the Taliban is in power, and the Al-Qaeda and even the Islamic State now are now getting rise in Afghanistan. Coming to that, the Islamic State was also able to intrude in Afghanistan. Now, Afghanistan was supposed to be just the Al-Qaeda, the Haqqani network funded by Pakistan and all other loosely affiliated terror organizations and the Taliban. But now who came into the picture was the Islamic State of Iraq and Syria in the Khorasan province. Now the ISIS-K is considered as one of the most active branches of ISIS in Afghanistan. And the most active branch of ISIL is probably in Yemen, I think, although that can be debated again. But ISIS-K, the reason I call ISIS-K a very active branch is because, very ironically, the Afghan army stood no chance to fight the Taliban. They were down in a week. The ISIS-K has been fighting till now, and this is again that concept coming to play. I am literally waiting to come to it. I am coming to it. Let's just get over with this important part. The ISIS-K is still fighting right now against Taliban. Very small attacks here and there, but it is pricking the Taliban a lot. The Northern Alliance tried to form a resistance front against the Taliban, but they ended up failing because this was coming out of Panjshir. Now Panjshir Valley is basically this, it's a valley, right? And it's obviously covered by hills, so it's difficult in such a terrain to fight. And I think this is also a strategic problem because when you have huge big terrains and uneven surfaces involved, it becomes difficult to fight a battle, especially with a force which uses guerrilla warfare. And that's the concept I'm going to talk about. Now look, what's happening right now is that Afghanistan has come back to Sharia law. The Taliban say they have changed. I mean, honestly, the second they said it, my reaction was, nah, you guys are lying. Because they aren't gonna change. It's the same Taliban of 1996. It's only, I mean, the Al-Qaeda is still in close relations with them. Women are still being treated badly in Afghanistan. Look, media coverage in Afghanistan pretty limited, and honestly, if the Taliban are holding a gun to your head while you're giving a media address, it says that the media aren't allowed in Afghanistan. So it's pretty, the message is pretty clear out there. What you see right now is amputations happening for the even smallest of crimes. Women being locked up at their homes. I mean, education for women being stopped. This is something very problematic in a place like Afghanistan. And you earlier had a lot of aspirations on the parts of women when the US was in there, when the Afghan government was there. And now you obviously have the Taliban bringing all of that effort down drains. I mean, even this, even when it comes to the economy, when inflation is now very high in Afghanistan, the IMF also not ready to give any money. The countries are freezing assets and freezing their foreign reserves completely to Afghanistan. When you find countries doing that, Afghanistan has no funding. Oh yeah, except for China. I mean, come on. China is always there for any country which supports terrorists and supports, supports people against America. I mean, that's China, what China does. I mean, look, I understand it. It's a very blatant allegation to say that China supports countries which support terrorists, but look at what the China does in the Security Council. China doesn't allow terrorists in Lashkar-e-Taiba and other organizations to be listed as terror organizations in the SC. It doesn't. The Security Council hasn't been able to make much progress because of China's constant blocking of terror names. Even India had this issue just a couple of weeks ago, I think, when India brought up this issue in the Security Council about listing of particular names of Lashkar-e-Taiba and other Pakistani-related organizations, listing them under the Security Council, imposing sanctions and whatnot. But China never allows that, and China has very rarely allowed terrorists to be listed from Pakistan, at least. And now you find China, which has been openly cooperating with the Taliban, and because there's one thing that China obviously fears here, there's a strategy in one way, because Taliban is in cooperation with Al-Qaeda. You all must have heard about the East Turkestan Islamic Movement, the ETIM, which is usually what the reason behind why China uses its most draconian measures on Uyghur Muslims. What happened was that in 2014 or sometime around then, China faced some of the worst terror attacks from the ETIM and related groups who were provoking Uyghur Muslims against the Chinese government, and they saw the worst violence till date. But obviously, it doesn't at all justify Chinese genocide in that region. It doesn't justify it at all. But yes, the ETIM has been a concern for China, security threat for China. And being with the Taliban, which obviously works with the Al-Qaeda, which is an organization where the ETIM originates, well, that's a strategic move. So we can't really blame China here. I mean, it's a strategic move on their part. And now they're looking forward to trading with Afghanistan, with providing them with funds, with humanitarian aid. And I mean, Afghanistan is full of minerals. Who wouldn't want to exploit them? I mean, it's got, I think, trillions of dollars of untapped mineral reserves. That's how much Afghanistan has. Even India, for a fact, has been following a big policy of strategic ambiguity. I know this is a term used for what the US does with Taiwan, but this is the same India is doing with the Taliban, because India is not exactly recognized Taliban government, but India is sending humanitarian aid. India did negotiate with Taliban for the release of some Indian some civilians who were there at the airport in Afghanistan, apparently. So considering all of these equations, you find this very complicated chain of events, and now you find Afghan civilians being brought to a problem because now there is no funding Afghanistan receives except from China, which is also looking forward to probably bring it under the Belt and Road Initiative, the BRI. It's pretty predictable because it's what China does. A country is weak in its economy, China gives the BRI. The BRI is an infrastructure project, and we all know it's Keynesian economics. I mean, come on, infrastructure means economic growth, right? So obviously China is looking forward to helping Afghanistan in that manner. Now, in the midst of all these atrocities, you find the civilian suffering, you also find a potential famine taking place in Afghanistan, and you obviously find humanitarian aid coming to almost no use, and countries and humanitarian agencies are facing lots of problems as to how they handle the situation in Afghanistan. Right now, let's come to a concept I was speaking to you about. This concept of warfare has been seen since Cold War times, but it's being used now to the highest level, and we still haven't found a way to crack it down upon it. That's guerrilla warfare, GUERRILLA warfare. That's how it is. You see, how did America lose Vietnam? It was the Viet Cong, right? Now, it was supported and armed by the Soviet Union. But the Viet Cong was a set of guerrilla fighters. Now, guerrilla warfare can be defined in multiple ways. It is Mao Zedong, who was the very first president of the People's Republic of China and leader of the PLA, the People's Liberation Army. He was the one who also had invented guerrilla warfare. Even Sun Tzu, who was a general in the who was a Chinese general in the 13th century or 14th century, I think, he had written a book called The Art of War, where he mentions about guerrilla warfare as well. Guerrilla warfare is basically a set of protracted conflicts, small fights here and there. You don't advance much, but you do enough to poke the enemy. It's like, say, How do you put this? I mean, okay, I mean, this looks very stupid, but I mean, find think of yourself as a small person and a bear. You poke the bear. Now, the bear won't attack you completely, but it will get disturbed, right? When it attacks you, it will do it in a huge burst, right? But then you'll still try, know that he's already, see, you're already attacking him, knowing he's gonna respond, right? So you're gonna be ready. So when he attacks you with a full thrust, you're ready for it and you evade. The same happens with guerrilla warfare. The only added part is that when the bear attacks you in guerrilla warfare, the other animals in the jungle see it. And then they say, that bear is the bad guy. Exactly. Guerrilla warfare is local warfare. It's very local in nature. I am not aware of any country which has been able to take down guerrilla fighters so far. At least I think Sri Lanka might be the only country, because Sri Lanka was fighting against this group called the LTTE, and it was this group which was involved in Sri Lanka in this warfare with the Sri Lankan government. Even I think India got involved in it, but there was a huge complication in India, in Indian Peace Corps, and even Prime Minister Rajiv Gandhi was assassinated, very sadly assassinated by the LTTE apparently, and which is why India I think withdrew. Now Sri Lanka was the only country able to take down the LTTE, I mean guerrilla warfare, guerrilla fighters. The Sri Lanka was able to bring down guerrilla fighters on their own, and I think that's one very fine example. I don't know any other country which has been able to do that, because frankly guerrilla warfare today has been completely a one way in which terror organizations and other organizations in the entire world have been able to crack down upon governments. You see the ISIS, see the Al-Qaeda, see the other organizations here and there. You find the Vietnam War, where the Viet Cong was involved. I think guerrilla warfare also involves basically provoking society against a particular government. And that is when guerrilla warfare becomes all the more successful. I think the way in which governments can, which, see, I have no military knowledge all right, but I'm going to make this very clear. I think governments can tackle this problem by basically using methods and tactics which aren't hard. Don't torture people, don't hunt down terrorists like through drone strikes, because civilian casualties, rather intel civilians, start information campaigns. Be like UN peacekeeping troops. I mean, I think UN peacekeeping troops have been able to draw success in this matter. We haven't given them much credit. We think UN peacekeeping operations aren't worth the effort, but they are. Because the UN peacekeeping troops, they have doctors with them, so that if any civilian has a problem, the doctors are going to help them. They provide information, they spread information and don't cooperate with this armed group. They aren't worth it. They don't pick up, peacekeeping troops don't pick up their gun first. They only defend, and I think that's what we have to do. Instead of going on the offensive, instead of them provoking us to go on the offensive, we should rather be careful and be defensive. But and rather should be preparing people in the way that, you know, we should gain support from civilians, because civilians play a huge role in any armed conflict. We don't have to arm civilians, but we have to ensure civilians not give themselves up to terrorists. And one of the main things in Afghanistan was exactly this. Why do you think the ISIS-K was able to survive against Taliban, not the Afghan National Army? Because the ISIS-K also uses guerrilla warfare, and Taliban realize it. Even Al-Qaeda has been doing this everywhere possible, in Yemen, in Syria, Jabhat al-Nusra, in even in Afghanistan, even the ISIL in Syria, in Yemen, in as Boko Haram in the Sahel region. So this concept obviously comes to play, and I think at the end of this, you know, when you look at Afghanistan, you cannot help but feel bad for the people there, feel bad at people out there suffering at this point. I mean, look, the US is a good force. I mean, come on, let's disagree. The US may not have, not so mistake, but they are better than terrorists. But the people, the civilians have to be made sure of that. The civilians have to be made sure that, you know, this is a good country who is supporting us. And that cannot happen if you conduct drone strikes against them and kill civilians. I think in this case, the US got a strategy wrong. And I think governments around the world, be it France, be it America, be it even in the East, I think we need to look at the way we fight terrorism. I think instead of focusing on counterterrorism, focus on counterinsurgency. Instead of focusing on fighting a terrorist, focus on ensuring a terrorist can't fight you. That's how you have to think. Because only if you have the support of the civilian population can you actually fight a war properly. This is how modern warfare is. It's fluctuating, it's developing, it's dynamic. And I think the most important part is that it requires the people's support here. Thank you very much for listening to this episode. And look out for the next one. I hope you liked it. And I'll be back really soon. Like and share this podcast. And follow it on Spotify. Send it to people. And please give us feedback. And ask us questions on the podcast to my email. heforeignpolicy101@gmail.com. I love to answer questions. I'll be now back with all the episodes. My exams are now over. I'm now going to be back on the podcast. So I'll be active. So please go ahead and ask me questions. By the way, on Instagram and Twitter, we are finally on those two places. You can check us out on Instagram. On Instagram, we are breaking down current affairs with a capital B and no spaces. So go ahead and check us out there. I even put in a description. And on Twitter, you can check us out at breakingdowncu1 with a capital B and no spaces. On Twitter, we do lots of things. We retweet stuff. We'll even do polls. And I think it's time you guys started interacting us on social media as well. So yeah, thank you very much for listening to this podcast, and I'll see you later.